Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
No fucking way. You made me look a right cunt.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello there, welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunner Blog. I don't know what to say to you. How are you?
I'm all right. Look, I think we're all looking for something to cling on to here. I can't believe it. I've just logged onto my Twitter, and I've seen a message there from, of all people, Hartley's Jam. Hartley's Jam have just tweeted saying, "It's International Day of Happiness. Time to be positive and brilliant." And then a little picture saying, "Be brilliant, be positive," with the Hartley's logo underneath. If that's not a sign, I don't know what is.
Well, look, to be fair, that has said pretty much everything that needs to be said. I don't know why we're going to bother with the rest of this podcast. Just be
positive.
Should
we call it a day?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, as always, for listening. We'll be back next week. Be positive, be brilliant. That's it. I mean, it's the mantra that we should all be working under. It just seems a bit of a shame that, Arsenal don't. Whoa.
That's what I was just going to come on and say. That was all I had to say today. Be positive, be brilliant, and good luck with your lives. This is my final podcast. I renounced my supportership of Arsenal over the weekend. I'll be entering retirement now.
Oh, look, if only it was that easy. We can't do that. That is the thing, isn't it? I have seen people who have said, look, that's it, no more. I can't take it anymore. I'm not watching this team. I just can't. I just know. But, that's, for me, that's just not an option. You just can't. You can't walk away, I guess. Some people are so disenfranchised that that's what they're going to do. But no, I for one, and I'm sure there are many of you out there listening, I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm just going to keep on going.
I know. Well, what's it been? 15 years doing the blog, something like that?
Yeah.
you're not the only one who's a glutton for punishment, judging by the back pages of the papers today.
Oh,
but where to start? I mean, it's sort of a diabolical weekend, really, in every respect. I mean, even kind of the other results sort of really didn't go our way.
Do you know what I did yesterday, rather than sort of pay any attention to what might happen in the other games? Yeah, football. Yeah. I drank beer and then wine.
Yeah.
And just didn't pay any attention
to it. Then you'll feel fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
Just...
That must have helped. Conversely, I don't know. I mean, again, glutton for punishment. I watched 3 Premier League games yesterday. I watched Manchester United win, then I watched Tottenham win, and then I watched Liverpool and Manchester City both gain a point. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Why do you hate yourself so much?
I think I was just trying to remind myself. I hate myself, and I was trying to remind myself that, there is another way. There is another way of playing football.
Maybe you need to talk to somebody about this.
I guess so.
Not me now.
So. Yeah, well... Oh, I see. Well, I was going to say, I've got the format here. I've got the forum for it. It's very convenient.
Yeah. I was in a bar. I was in a bar when the Tottenham game was on. And what did they score? Inside about 10 minutes or 12 minutes?
Something like that.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake. Just now.
Turning a table over.
Yeah, I'm getting out of here. I'm going to somewhere else where they don't show any football on the screens. So, Where do we start? I think we've got to talk about the match. We've got to talk about the West Brom game, and then we can talk about all the other stuff that's going on or is rumored to be going on or isn't going on, whatever the case may be.
Okay.
So,
Thomas Tuchel, our new manager, you mean?
Yeah. Is it Tuchel? Is it Tuchel? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, I don't actually know, to be fair. Tuchel probably, isn't it?
Mm.
Let's start with the game. Let's go to the Hawthorns.
Bring it on.
I don't know. I mean, well, they've become Stoke, haven't they, West Brom?
They have. It's quite uncanny. A lot of fouling. fans getting mad at our players for getting their ankles kicked off. Fairly direct. Now, to be fair, I don't think they were quite as Stokey as the worst Stoke have ever been. But there's definitely elements of Stoke to them, as you would expect under Tony Pulis. But you know what, though? Not that I admire it in any way, but it's not as if that would have been any surprise to us, or should have been any surprise to us. You know, we knew what way they were going to play.
Yeah. For a start. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know.
And, can you see that I'm struggling to get my words out here today?
Yeah, I can. I can.
What happened? Okay, so look, we picked a team that I thought was a good team to pick. I was, believe it or not, before kickoff, I was quite excited to see that team play. I thought it was an interesting 11. We had that 4-3-3, you know, that had kind of been doing okay. I thought Danny Welbeck, Alexis and Walcott sounded like a promising front 3-2. So, you know, I was feeling curious. I won't say optimistic, but curious to see how we got on. And then we conceded a corner.
Well, you know what was interesting about that was the corner came from Alexis, I think it was, who gave the ball away quite cheaply in their half of the pitch, in the bit that, you know, they existed in for most of the game. You know, we got cut open really easily because we were pushed so far forward. I think it was James McLean who took a shot and Petacek scored the goal. And then we saw, the goal was really, really irritating and annoying. And I know they did this to death on Sky, didn't they? The way they analysed the goals and zonal marking and everything else. And Ramsey stood and watched Craig Dawson, didn't make any effort to get in his way or to challenge him. I think it was Granit Xhaka who vacated his zone, and there was all the space in the world for him to head into. And when you add that goal to the third goal, and you look at what was said before the game by the manager about how we have to be careful about them on set pieces and we have to pay attention and everything else, it was very, very disappointing to see the players not bother their arse, carry out any of the instructions. I assume there were some instructions, right? You don't just talk about, well, West Brom are good in the air from set pieces. I presume you don't just say that to the press. I assume there's been some focus on that on the training ground, right?
You'd think. it would be strange not. I mean, the curious thing about the whole set piece thing is that we actually have been all right, haven't we, defending corners this season. For the most part, I think we've only conceded one Premier League goal from a corner going into the West Brom game. So something, you know, has been working, because that's been a vulnerable area for us in the past. But against West Brom, that just went out the window. And I think partly that's down to the quality of what they do. I mean, look, they're good deliveries, they're good runs. But when you look at it, that first goal, Dawson, who ultimately scores it, has a completely free run. I mean, as the corner comes in, he's literally got his hands up. He's the only man in the box free with his hands up, as if saying, like, me, it's my ball. And then he just runs past Ramsey so clean and so clear. It's kind of unforgivable, really. I mean, I can't explain it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even as if he's standing there waving to say, you know, play the ball to me here. It's like, put the ball in an area where I can go and attack it. And look, you know, Ramsey's not the guy who's going to win you loads of headers in your box, but you don't have to be 6'5" to make it really difficult for a bigger opponent to get the header. Just stand in his way.
Block him off. Do anything.
Do
that's
the
what
stuff that other teams do to us. You know, it's, you know, just compete. That's the thing. Compete with the guy. At least try. Mm-hmm. It makes it much more difficult. You know, to win headers. Headers are a great skill, you know. It looks relatively easy to plant the ball home from close range. But, you know, if you've got a guy who's jumping with you and is all over you and is putting you off balance, it becomes much, much more difficult to do it. Much, much more difficult. It was just, pathetic, really. That defending was absolutely pathetic. And then we scored, which was nice. He had a goal.
It was nice. I mean, it was a good goal. It was kind of a goal that they was kind of their fault too. I mean, they left Alexis so free at the far post. It was kind of the one time their defence granted us that much space, really. But having left him there, it was a good ball from Xhaka and a really nice take from Alexis and a very immediate response. So at that time,
yeah,
you know, it felt like, oh, right, OK, we've got a foothold back in this game.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We've responded. We've shown a bit of character and what have you. But, I mean, the rest of the half, lots of Arsenal possession. But, again, West Brom seemed to be much more threatening than we were. They had some... I can't remember if they had good chance. Yeah, Cech had to make a really good save, didn't he? Just before he went off.
Really good save. Darren Fletcher, yeah, who was left free sort of in the corner of the box. And, yeah, there was that McLean shot where he went clear. It was the pattern of the game, really, that we had so much possession, but they certainly had the better chances in both halves.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we were, like, sterile, I think was the word I used on the blog yesterday, and that is... it's just how we play, you know, lots and lots of possession, but you just pass it backwards and pass it sideways and go from one side of the pitch to the other side of the pitch. And there's no incision or no real ambition to do anything. You know, you see at times you see this Arsenal team passing the ball around and you're looking for someone to move, like somebody make a forward run. Or somebody try and get between the lines and somebody try and find him with a pass. The only person, or two people I would say, who showed any ambition in their passing were Alexis Sanchez, who we know tries to make things happen, and Granit Xhaka, who, to his credit, a few times spread the ball wide and put us in positions where we could have perhaps attacked the fullbacks. But what happens? We get the ball in those areas and we go backwards again and we start that gigantic arc across the pitch and backwards and here we go again, you know? So it's really frustrating to watch us play like that. Thoughts on the challenge on Alexis Sanchez?
Oh, it's a bad tackle. I mean, to be honest, for me it probably was a yellow rather than a red, but what riles me is the way, and I know you talked about this on your blog, the way that it's kind of reported and commentated on, you know, that thing of like a sort of healthy, good challenge. I mean, it was an ugly tackle, and no surprise really that eventually he was kind of forced from the field by it. I thought it was very, very cynical. One of those where it's like the player must know that he, you know, he's not going to win the ball, he's going to take the man.
Yeah. Look, McLean has some, he's got some history, you know, in that regard.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I don't think we can just put it down to a tackle that was badly timed. He didn't care if it was that badly timed. He knew if he wasn't going to get the ball, he was going to take the man, and that was what he wanted to do, and he did that. And again, you know, I'm tired of talking about the TV commentators and the pundits and everybody glossing over these bad tackles, and I really don't care whether it happens to an Arsenal player or any other player. This focus on, well, the physicality of the game, you know, it's all part and parcel the rough and tumble of Premier League football. And of course, you don't want it to be like a non-contact sport, but they have to start talking about these tackles in a more serious way, because ultimately it'll be an Arsenal player, it'll be some other player who gets injured, then they'll all get on their high horses, they'll pontificate about how this sort of thing can't happen, and then we have the whole he's not that kind of player thing will come out, and it's just, it's a problem, I think, within the English game, that this stuff is tolerated the way that it's tolerated, and in some ways lauded and lionized by certain sections of the media. You know, this guy, he's soft because, well, he plays for Arsenal. He's not soft because he plays for Arsenal. He's lying on the ground in pain because a guy came in at top speed and put his fucking studs in his ankle, you cunts. That's why he's fucking in pain, not because he's a fucking softy. It's really irritating, really irritating. And maybe, you know, I know we're speculating and, you know, our problems go much more, much deeper than just Alexis Sanchez being injured. But maybe if you have Alexis Sanchez fully fit in that second half, he is a player who can make a difference in a game. He is a player who can get you a goal, who can inspire the team, who can drive the team forward. He's not always going to do it, but he is capable of it. But when he's playing on one foot, he really fucking isn't.
Yeah, and I did feel like they were fouling him rotationally. I did feel like there was a clear decision to kind of almost take him out, really. There was sort of, there was foul after foul on Alexis.
He was getting very, very irritated by it as well, wasn't he? And he was talking to the ref about it. There were a number of times where he was clearly fouled and the referee played on. And Sanchez, it looked to me like Sanchez was much more likely to get a booking than any of the players who were fouling him because he was talking about it to the referee all the time.
Yeah, I thought he was going to get himself booked, but I could understand his frustration. And he's not a player you could ever really accuse of being soft. You know, that's not something you would level at him. So I think that tells you something about the treatment he was getting. I don't know who the Sky co-commentator was. I was watching on Sky, but he was absolutely infuriating.
Yeah, I don't know who it was either because I didn't recognise the voice at all. So maybe if you're listening to this and you know who it was, you know, drop us a tweet, please. That would be appreciated. But he was very very irritating. All right. So we go behind. I mean, look, just before they scored, they had a glorious chance. Rondon had a great chance to score with a header.
Oh, from a header,
from a McLean cross, which we just didn't bother closing down. We didn't close him down and cut off the supply. Rondon headed wide. Almost immediately he got taken off and they brought on fake Kanu. And he scored the goal.
I was actually pleased when Rondon went off because I thought he was quite sort of burly and giving our centre-backs a bit of a tricky time. But, yeah, immediately Kanu comes on and scores. We haven't talked about the goalkeeper change. Obviously, we were forced into a switch with Belichick going off of David Ospina. And, you know, while Ospina's done OK this season, I suspect Tony Pulis probably would have been pleased to see him come on rather than Cech, you know, especially on the set-piece front.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Ospina's not a goalkeeper that you want in your team when you're facing, you know, imagine Ospina against the Stokiest Stoke of all time. Remember when Rory Delap used to fling in those long throws in the corners and this fucking 6'4", you know, fullbacks and defenders and midfielders all in there. I mean, he would just have nightmares about it. And he's not the goalkeeper you want in a game like that. I don't think he was. I thought he was poor for the second goal. I thought he should have come and taken the ball. He should have been more decisive. He might have got hurt. But, you know, isn't that part and parcel of the job?
Yeah, I was chatting to a mate of mine who plays in goal, actually, and he was like, that looked like me when I first started playing in goal and I was a bit afraid of getting hurt. Like, ultimately, that ball is there for him to take, but he kind of bottles it. Mm. And it's not a good look. It's not a good look for a spinner. And, you know, then Robson Kanu just sort of pokes it home. I mean, it was a calamity, really.
Yeah.
Goal. It wasn't pretty.
It wasn't good at all. But, I mean, look, still, that was very early in the second half. And you have all that time to get yourself another goal or maybe another two goals if you can manage that. But we were absolutely toothless. Toothless. Like Welbeck, you know, I like Danny Welbeck, but he looked like a guy who was seriously rusty. Olivier Giroud came on, didn't really get a kick. Theo Walcott, where was the anger at being left out of the England squad? It wasn't evident in his performance. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain was poor. Aaron Ramsey was poor. Alexis, of course, was hobbled, so he couldn't really make an impact. You know, it was just, it felt more like they were going to score again than we were going to get an equaliser. Always.
I mean, I'm trying to remember chances that we had. Apart from Welbeck heading against the bar, I cannot remember another chance.
Penalty on Mustafi?
Yeah, possibly a penalty. That was in the immediate aftermath of that, wasn't it? I think that was the same corner. Yeah, it could well have been. But aside from that, I'm just thinking, I mean, I almost can't even remember a shot in anger, to be honest with you.
We had two shots
on target.
On target in the second half. I don't know who they came from. I'm just looking at my Stat Zone app here. No, we had,
I think that was in the whole game, wasn't it?
No, we had no shots on target in the second half. We had five attempts, no goals, no shots on target. And obviously, Danny Welbeck hitting the bar was as close as we came. And that was from a corner set piece. And then they scored the third goal. Did you watch, I don't tend to watch the analysis on Sky afterwards, but did you watch it on Saturday?
I did see it, yeah.
Well, look, Thierry Henry had something to say about the way that They defended the goal again. Aaron Ramsey let Craig Dawson run off him. And what was interesting to me when I looked at that was after the first goal, they had another corner not too long afterwards. And again, there was the same situation where Craig Dawson was waiting for the ball. And Ramsey was like, okay, I made a mistake that time. I'm gonna do my bit. And he competed with him for the corner. But then by the third goal, he just gave up again. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain strolling back in. You know, he was there and could have done more. I mean, it was really half-hearted attempt to block him off, wasn't it? You know. It's like, oh,
I mean, have you seen that snapshot of Arsenal's players all sort of crowded at the near post and three West Brom players completely free at the far post? I mean, it is literally the case that if Dawson hadn't put it in... In fact, when it happened in real time, I couldn't tell who had scored because there were so many West Brom players who could have put that in the net.
It's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you know, that if that is zonal marking, then... those players did not attend to their zones, because I find it impossible to believe that their instructions are abandon your zones and all stand at the near post.
Pick a zone, any zone.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, when the whistle blows, all run into your favourite zone.
Yeah, don't tell anyone which
like
zone
sardines.
That is.
Exactly. but I mean, I'm laughing now, but I certainly wasn't at the time. And it was just, you know... I mean, I think that it was one of those things where, like, the commentator was like, a corner West Brom, will they look for Dawson again? They have. It was like one of those things where it was kind of self-fulfilling. It just happened. It was, it just played out exactly as your nightmares would imagine it. Mm. And 3-1. And I mean, that's a big scoreline to lose to any team, let alone a team ensconced in mid-table like West Brom, who don't necessarily have loads to play for. I mean, we had loads of possession, but it was so passive. And when you look at teams like, I don't know, I watched City-Liverpool yesterday, and when they get the ball, they at least have a real intent to go forward and score goals. There's a menace about their play that there just isn't in Arsenal's at the moment. And we just wilted in every respect. And it was, at a time when we were looking for something different, something to pick us up, it was just more of the same, but against a lower quality of opposition, which I guess makes it all the more painful.
Yeah, I was afraid it was going to get worse.
Genuinely. Yeah, me too. I thought this could be 4-5. Yeah. I was like, imagine if it is. I mean, it could have been, you know, we were getting hit on the break with such ease.
Yeah.
That it genuinely could have been ugly, a bit like, you know, the final stages of those Munich games, except it's West Brom.
Yeah, exactly. That was what was in my head, and I think... You know, had it been a team of greater quality, it could have been. Like, losing 5-1 to Bayern Munich is not good. Losing 5-1 to West Brom, but even losing 3-1 to West Brom, I'm sorry. You know, it's just not good enough for this club and for these players to play the way that they did, or not to play the way that they did. Do you draw anything from that performance? You know, it struck me for the first time that I can remember during Arsene Wenger's reign, the thought occurred to me that these players are not playing for him, that they're not giving everything that they can give for this football club. Because, you know, we can criticize a manager and we will talk about him. Of course, we're going to talk about him. But, you know, the players, as soon as they pull on that shirt, have got a responsibility to the club, to the team, to each other, to the fans, to the people that pay their wages. They have a responsibility to give 100%. I know it sounds cliche, but, you know, give 100%. Give everything you've got. You know, do your jobs. Do the basics. Do what you're supposed to do. Do what you're told to do. Defend corners. Don't slack off. Don't look around and expect somebody else to do the job that you're supposed to do. That's the bare minimum. And those players didn't do that. And it was obvious that they weren't doing it. And you've got to wonder, why are they not doing it? Is the message, or whatever the manager is saying to them, is it just going in one ear and out the other now? I think it is. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you're right. The players do have to take some criticism for not taking responsibility. I think, but I also kind of think it's almost, and I'm not making excuses for them, but it's almost not their fault. I almost think it is now a consequence of the situation and the environment. Like, there's such a problem of accountability at Arsenal that it's kind of filtered down to the players, and there's no culture of fear, I guess, really. There's no... They're so used to Arsene Wenger being there that the instructions, as you say, have ceased to carry the same weight. There's no fearing of the consequences of not following them. They think he'll still be there. They think they'll still be there. It's just so comfortable that they have become lazy. People, footballers particularly, seem to require stakes in order to motivate themselves. And it just feels like the stakes at Arsenal aren't high enough, which is perverse from the outside because there's so much pressure. But I just think internally, there kind of isn't enough.
Yeah, the fabled comfort zone, I guess you would say. I mean, I wouldn't abdicate them of responsibility in the same way that you do, or not to blame them in the same way. I think, you know, regardless of what's going on, I still feel like they have underperformed. And whether it's conscious or subconscious, whether it's to do with the manager, whether it's to do with just, you know, existing within this comfort zone, I don't know. But I don't think I can give them a, you know, any kind of a free pass in that regard. I still think they should do better. But what I would say is that I feel like the whole situation in this football club, nobody has a fucking clue what is going on. Yeah. I think that includes the players. I think that I don't believe that this environment that is there at this moment in time is in any way healthy. I think it's obvious now that the uncertainty that surrounds the manager, the uncertainty that surrounds various other things, you know, at the club, contract situations with top players, it's all feeding into what's happening on the pitch. You can see the consequences of this lack of leadership. We've spoken about it before, like, about how there doesn't seem to be any direction from the very top of the club. It's not there. That people are happy for things to just kind of chug along in this weirdly chaotic way. Oh, I know what I'm going to do, says Arsene Wenger after the game. Does anybody else know? No. No. Nobody else knows. So he's made a decision in his own mind, which we think we know based on the newspaper speculation, but nobody is coming out to say they're okay with this.
Like, how insane is that? How insane is that? It's so
nuts.
It's mad. I mean, the players, it's so funny. We spent so long, you know, wondering if Arsenal had enough leaders on the pitch that we forgot to check if they had any off the pitch.
Yeah.
And we don't.
No,
and it's much more concerning. It's much more concerning because the club, you know, Jeremy Wilson of the Telegraph described the uncertainty as corrosive, and I think that's a good description. Mm. It is eating away at the club now. And to come back to the players, it's like, on a very simple level, obviously they should be playing, obviously they're pros, but who are they playing for? Are they playing for Arsene Wenger? Are they playing for the next manager? You know, what I think you want to know your future. You want, as an employee, you want to know what the plan is. You want to know what the hell is going on. To a certain extent, they're in the same boat as us. And if we as fans are, you know, thinking, oh, well, that's it, I'm chucking in the towel, I'm not going to do the podcast, I'm not going to go to the game next week, you know, obviously they're paid professionals, but in the back of their minds, they probably feel a bit the same. And I think as well, you can't also rule out the possibility that some of them are maybe welcoming the idea of a new manager. I don't even think they, you know, they consciously know they think that. But if they wanted Arsene Wenger in charge, surely they'd be giving more on the field than they are at present.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. How many stories have we seen over the last few weeks? We've let the manager down. You know, we've got to do better. We've got to play better. He's shown such faith in us, et cetera, that our performances haven't repaid that faith. Blah, 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 blah. Look at what happened at West Brom. That's the answer. That's where you draw the truth from what happens on the pitch and the way that players behave and the way that they perform. And it's clear that there's a big, big problem there. A big problem.
Yeah, it's action speaking louder than words,
yeah,
isn't it? You know, I mean, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain came out after the game and was very apologetic for the performance and said it wasn't good enough. But without wanting to scapegoat, I mean, he was absolutely dreadful on those set pieces. Like, he was so poor and so lacklustre. So it doesn't add up. Like, this thing of, like, oh, you know, we want to perform for the manager, we feel like we're letting him down, we want him to stay. That's not what I'm seeing on the field. It's almost like we're kind of willing the worst-case scenario.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when a team pretty much downs tools the way that they did, you can draw one or two conclusions from that, and they're pretty obvious. But let's go on to the manager then, and the decision that he's made. When he said that, when that story broke on Saturday afternoon after the game, we were chatting on WhatsApp. And it's quite
maybe,
funny.
Maybe we'll get some free WhatsApp now.
Yeah, we
now
get some,
mentioned that.
We get some free WhatsApp. Hang on, let me just see if I can. Blah blah blah. I think we're on the cusp of free crisps. No, that was a different thing. You said big quote from Arsene today. Is that it? And I said, sounds like it, doesn't it? And you said, yeah, I guess it has to be. Then was sort of more chat about the game itself. And that
crisps.
Was that,
we probably went back to the crisps.
We went
as
back
well.
To crisps, yeah, and biscuits and cakes and free things. But that was what we were thinking in the immediate aftermath of that game. And when he made that comment, it looked to me, that's what I thought. I thought that was like a, well, you know, that's it. But it appears that it's quite the opposite. That according to all the reports in the paper, so the Mirror went with it, the Telegraph went with it, the Guardian went with it, the Mail went with it, Arsene Wenger has decided to stay. Now, having spoken at his press conference, he was asked, does anybody else know what your decision is? And he said, no. Now we have this story that's out where he's decided to stay. Now, has he briefed the press? Has his agent or manager briefed the press? I don't think so. If the club are briefing the press in that way, how do you read it? It's incredibly clumsy if it is the club or the communications department, or if it's coming from, you know, a board level, that this is the decision that he's made. It's incredibly clumsy in terms of the timing. Or do you, as I speculated in the blog today, is this perhaps another way for the club to fan the flames of ire and anger towards the manager, based on what Ivan Gazidis said about the fans who will ultimately decide his future? Silent Stan and silent Ivan, who's been nowhere to be seen, would it be convenient for them to leak the story about another 2 years, knowing exactly how it would go down in the wake of a terrible defeat and a terrible performance? Sounds a bit conspiracy theory-esque, but they haven't shown the bottle or the spine to deal with this in any other way, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's what it was.
Well, I was going to ask you about this. I've got a vague memory of that happening before. Maybe it was in 2013, 2014, when we were last talking about Arsene Wenger's renewal. I've got a memory of a story coming out saying that... Hello.
Hello.
I've knocked my microphone over.
That's
in my,
okay. Sort
of, as I huddled around it, being all like, I've got a memory. But no, back in 2013, 14, I seem to recall a similar story. I think it was earlier in the season, saying that Arsene Wenger had agreed a new contract. Was it around Bayern Munich or something like that? Around a Bayern Munich game, and Arsene Wenger coming out saying that's absolutely not true.
Yes.
I can't. And he was very angry about it. And he was like, this is a, you know, this is a damaging lie about the club.
Yeah.
And I, again, we never really got to the bottom of the story, but there was a bit of a sense of, had it been put out potentially by the club in order to create some pressure on him to make a decision. And I don't know, but I guess it's possible that a similar thing is happening this
time
around.
Okay, here it is. I found it, actually. Ivan Gazidis, in January 2014, this was a kit announcement, a Puma thing. And he said, we are comfortable and relaxed. Arsene will be extending with us, and at the right time, we'll announce it. Now, I can't quite remember when that Wenger story was. Let me just see. I'm just going to try and search here. I can't remember exactly when that denial was.
No. Me neither, but I have a memory of it. Yeah. And don't you? Was it? I don't know if it involved Neil Ashton, but I feel like it might have done.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Was that the you know, why are you looking at me? Why are you looking at me? I think that could have been it. Let me just see if I can find it here. But yeah, it wouldn't be beyond the club to do that, I don't think, at this moment in time. And while we're on this, right? Mm. There's a lot of focus on the manager, and it's his intention to stay. And I think I saw somebody on Twitter say this. I can't remember who it was, so apologies. But basically, all managers think that they're capable of turning it around until such point as they get the boot, right? So, This is Arsene Wenger. This is what he... this is what he thinks, that he can still work hard. And I know Philippe Auclair was tweeting about it last night, saying that, look, he's aware of the unrest, but this will only spur him to work harder and to try and prove that he's still capable of doing it. But let's, for all the power that Arsene Wenger has at Arsenal Football Club, right, let's not ignore the fact that he hasn't drafted up a new contract for himself. This contract is on offer from the board, from the club, from Ivan Gazidis, from Stan Kroenke. They've agreed that this is what they want to happen. And, they're allowing this situation to develop and to fester, because I think this is what it is. It's a situation that has been allowed to fester. This uncertainty over his contract, will he, won't he? Are you going to stay? Are you not going to stay? To complete almost total silence from the board, apart from the other day when we got Sir Chips and he came out and released a statement saying this will be a mutual decision. That's as much as we've got from them. But they're the ones that have offered him this contract that some people say has already been signed, and it's just a matter of waiting for the right time to announce it. Like, when the fuck is the right time to announce that? Now, I don't know how you fucking sell that. You could have the best PR people in the world, and you're not going to be able to sell that as a good thing to a large number of people.
I mean, it's so baffling. And what changed that Arsene Wenger said, I know what I will do? Do you think he was just being kind of prickly and trying to get reporters off his back? Or do you think something had actually changed, that he sat there in that press conference and was like, oh, now I know what I'm going to do, played his cards close to his chest?
My feeling was that, having watched that and having seen those players play the way that they did, he had come to some sort of realisation that they're not doing it for me anymore. That's what I thought. Mm. And he went, okay, maybe it's time. That was my initial feeling about it. As to why he then decided to say, if his intention is to stay, to announce that he has made a decision in the wake of a game like that, I've got no idea. James, I can't fucking figure out what the fuck is going on with this football club. I really am at my wit's end trying to make sense of it all. Look at this. Look at the fucking, look at this football club. The biggest football club in London, in the biggest city in Europe, with a magnificent stadium, amazing stadium, brilliant training facilities, which are being upgraded, fantastic resources, financial potential, infrastructure, loads of staff and employees. Maybe we're short in some areas, but it's a big fucking business machine now, as well as being a football club. The potential that this football club has is enormous. It is absolutely, I won't say unlimited, but it has the potential to be a massive football club. And what we don't have is anybody who has the drive or ambition to make this football club as good as it should be. Because if you look at the board, you know, bar someone like Sir Chips and Ken Fryer, who's been on the board for many years, the incumbents now, Stan Kroenke and Ivan Gazidis, they inherited this stadium. They inherited that potential that was put in place by the previous board. And you can criticize them if you want for selling up and everything else, and that's fine. I get it. But at least they had the drive to make something happen. And at that point, they could have said, look, we've done everything we can. You know, now it's somebody else's turn to take this club forward. Take this stadium. 60,000 people, brilliant facilities, brilliant views, all the fucking corporate shit that you need And you have to have it, as much as we dislike it. You've got to have this corporate environment to a football club. That's where the big money comes in. Like, good luck selling Europa League or no European football to those guys next year. But anyway, you know, here it is that board made that happen because they knew that for the football club to be as big as it could be, it had to happen. As much as we all loved Highbury and everything else, it had to happen if you want to really compete with these big clubs. So in comes Stan Kroenke, in comes Ivan Gazidis, and what's happened since? Nothing. Like, there's no ambition, no desire to make this club as good as it can be. I think back to 2015, right? When in 2013 we signed Mesut Ozil, 2014 we signed Alexis Sanchez. We win the FA Cup in 2014 and 2015. We're back winning trophies again. 2015, that summer, is the summer where you make a statement. You say, right, we've had bad years. Things have been tight. Things have been difficult for various reasons. We all know what they are, but we've bought a world-class player in 2013, a world-class player in 2014. We've got two FA Cups under our belt. Now is the time, with the purse strings loosened, now is the time to go and fucking make another statement. Go out and get another fucking top player, a really world-class player. And all we did was bring in Petr Cech. And that's not to be dismissive of Petr Cech, because at the time, I think everybody viewed it as a good signing. A signing that we needed because, you know, the goalkeeping situation was so up in the air. But where was the person at that football club to make it happen? If Arsene Wenger decided, well, no, I think I'm happy enough to stick with what I've got. No, we're not doing that. We're going to bring in a fucking top-class midfielder, or we're going to bring in a top-class defender. Then you make a statement. Then you show that you're serious about competing for the Premier League and for the Champions League, as well as the FA Cup. But they sit in their fucking hands. They just sit on their hands and they watch the value of the club increase, the share value of the club increase, the property values increase, more money comes into the club from broadcasting, and you know the place is just awash with cash. It's a cash cow for Stan Kroenke, and apart from that, he doesn't really care about it. And that's where we are.
I hear you, and that is definitely true, but how do you square the fact that ultimately it's the manager who has complete control of football decisions?
But that's on them as well, isn't it?
He didn't make those signings.
But is that not on them too? Do they not have to take some...
That he's in that position.
Yeah. Do they not have to take some responsibility for that? For allowing that power vacuum, A, to be created, and B, to continue? Without anybody thinking, you know, along the way, hey, you know what, maybe Arsene, you could do a better job. No one's doubting how hard you work, but maybe you could do a better job if you didn't have to do fucking everything. If you had people around to support you. Or if indeed there was a little bit of pressure on you.
Well, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. And that is incumbent on the board. I mean, It's been an awkward transition for them, really, I guess, in terms of like inheriting the club at a time when Arsene Wenger is there. I guess they felt like they don't want to challenge his authority, but that has had pretty dire consequences. And created a very problematic situation that has led directly to the mess we're in now. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, how did you feel when the stories broke last night that said that the manager has decided to stay?
I felt like it was the wrong thing for the football club. I think,
yeah,
you know, and probably the wrong thing for Arsene Wenger.
Yeah, I mean, I felt kind of like, I wouldn't say surprised because nothing surprises me anymore.
No,
but I guess kind of disappointed. Really, I think it would be the wrong call. And, you know, I do think that it's worth saying that what Arsene Wenger wants and what actually happens could not be the same thing if the board had any conviction.
Well, yeah.
But I don't think they do.
Well, they offered him the deal. It's not like, you know, they offered it to him. So he's going, yeah, I think I'll sign it. But they're
I mean, the question is, if you earn £8 million a year, would you sack yourself?
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, exactly. Or if you're in a job that you love, at a club that you love, yeah. you know, and you feel like you still can contribute and you feel like you can still do better and you want to prove that, okay, this was a bad season, but, you know, I can do better. You know, it's not... I can sort of understand it from Wenger's point of view, why he would want to continue.
Do you think that if that is what he wants, that will be a big part of it, not wanting to go out on a low, basically?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there comes a point where, you know, I'm not saying he exists in a bubble or anything like that. He's clearly a very intelligent man, but we know he's a stubborn man, quite intransigent, who has, you know, a lot of faith in himself and his ability as a manager and wants to win things. I'm sure he wants more than anything to win things. But what's becoming very clear is that he can't. Not the Champions League, not the Premier League. I love an FA Cup, but, you know, we're not competitive in either of those competitions.
19 points off Chelsea, I think we are, as we stand.
There's probably something about, you know, how we're closer to, the, you know, the bottom, yeah, the relegation zone than the leaders.
There's probably one of those around.
One of those. But, I mean, does that not tell its own story? And I did a post the other day on Ars blog about how, you know, at this time of the year, when you go to February, March, April, May, how close have we been? How close have we been to actually winning the Premier League? And for some years, I can understand why we weren't completely. But we're just not competitive in the competitions that are the bread and butter. Certainly the Premier League, Champions League. You know, do I have any realistic expectations of us winning it? No. But doing better than we have done, yeah. You know? So, look.
Yeah, it's...
The whole thing's...
The whole thing is a mess, and there's now an international break where if you were going to announce something either way, this would be the time, maybe, because, you know, there's a bit of time off from the football and...
But you can't, can you? You can't announce...
You can't announce a new contract.
You can't. You just can't. Like, I don't know what's going to happen between now and the end of the season. We've lost 4 of our last 5 games. We've won 3 of our last 9, and 2 of those were against non-league sides. This is a team that looks broken, and I don't think he can fix it. At which point, you have to ask the question, when on earth is it going to be possible to announce a 2-year deal? If he's already signed it, or if that's what he wants. You've got to win. You're going to have to beat Man City. You're going to have to beat Man City twice, get to an FA Cup final. You're going to have to beat Tottenham away from home. You're going to have to beat Manchester United to have any chance, realistically, of getting into that top four, which is, you know, the bare minimum. Wasn't it interesting? Did he say something about, you know, we don't need to finish in the top four?
Yeah, he said, financially, it doesn't have the weight it once had.
Yeah, financially.
My future's not dependent on it.
Yeah. But I mean, it's...
that's a change of tune, isn't it?
What are we going for now? You know, 6th place trophy? It's not... You can't... you can't hold up top four as the bare minimum, which is what he said many times. But the bare minimum is top four. That's the least that we want from a season, is what he said, is what Ivan Gazidis has said. You can't now turn around and start dismissing it. Now, I get the point. It is not as financially important as it used to be. Champions League money used to be the thing that would set a club apart. It would give them an advantage in terms of what they could spend in the transfer market and on wages. That's completely gone now because of the Sky and BT broadcasting rights deal. Like, everybody's rich now. So Champions League money is not as important as it was, but it still is important for the prestige of a club to be playing European football. I mean, you know, do you attract a player like Alexis Sanchez if you can't offer them Champions League football? Don't think so.
No.
So anyway.
No, and I mean, and as for Alexis Sanchez, I mean, I was thinking yesterday, you know, that... His contract situation, Mesut Ozil's contract situation, barely getting a mention at the moment. And that's partly, I guess, because Arsenal is taking the headlines. But also, there seems to be a sense of resignation, really, about their future.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fucking maddening, and like, I think like we're going to probably see the birth of a new football chant at the Emirates, which is going to be "We don't know what you're doing," because we haven't got a fucking clue what the club are up to. I you know, when like you follow a club for a long time and you feel like you understand the manager's behaviour, the owner's behaviour, you can kind of read between the lines and see what's going on. Right now, hand on heart, I haven't got a clue. I haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
And it's... That's scary. It's scary for me.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It's impossible to look at what's going on and think this is a cohesive, well-organised, well-run football club that knows what it's doing, that knows what it wants to do, where it wants to go, and how it wants to get there. You cannot fucking tell me that's the case with this football club right now.
Well, it's not. It's not. And, and there's a lot of potential for it to get worse before it gets better. I'm getting this in before the break because I feel like I need to say that and then we can move on. But like I do, when I look at the fixtures, as you say, you're like, well, when's the positive upturn going to be where you could sneak out an announcement about a new contract? Because genuinely, it could get worse. And any announcement about a new contract could play a big part in it getting worse, because the atmosphere after that, I daren't even predict what it will be like. Toxic it will be.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's fucking nuts. Yeah. Right, well, look, let's take a break because this has been a fairly epic first half. We'll take a break. We'll do some questions, of course, many of which are on the themes that we've already covered, but we'll try and provide a bit of variety and more in part two right after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arseblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arseblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arseblog. Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra, this most cheery of episodes. This is part two, where we answer the questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Facebook page, which is facebook.com/TheArsBlog. Before we do the questions, you have a little bit of a clarification on something we spoke about in the first half.
Yeah, we were talking about the kind of Arsene Wenger, Neil Ashton face-off, and I should clarify, I think that was in February 2013. So he still had over a year to... Did he have a year to run his contract? Yeah, he had a year to run his contract at the time. But there was a story saying that he was on the verge of signing an extension anyway. And then that riled Arsene, said, you know, if this is the wrong information, I deserve better than to have wrong information. And, you know, you looking at me, all that kind of his Travis Bickle moment. But I think, you know, the thrust remained the same, that a story came out about a new contract at a time where it was very kind of controversial.
Yeah.
There was a slight sense of maybe it was to pressure him into some sort of decision. Didn't work, and we had to wait until May 2014 to find out what he was going to do. So some things never change.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, look, here's the first question. This comes from Mike, who's at MCHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHHH Anyway, he says, do you think Mesut Ozil will miraculously have recovered by Wednesday's Germany-England international?
Yes. Well, he's meeting up with the squad, I believe. It's a very interesting one, this. I mean, it's sort of been, you know, the final paragraph in all the Wenger stories today, saying that Mesut Ozil trained on Friday and was widely expected to be left out of the team for West Brom, and then suddenly wasn't fit. And if I'm right, that's exactly what happened with the Liverpool game too. So it's a little bit fishy, isn't it? It feels like he's had a minor injury or a spot of illness quite a lot of late.
Does, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I suppose if he was really not going to be involved, then maybe they would just say it was a long-term injury. They'd just say his leg had fallen off and we'd never see him again. It's always like a minor complaint that's keeping him out, but it's definitely fishy, I think. I mean, do you think we're right to be a bit suspicious of it?
Yeah. I don't think there's... Look, you can never know, obviously, unless you're there, you know, what a player's fitness really is. And maybe he is injured, maybe he has been sick, and, you know, I don't want to do him any disservice. But I think when you look at those comments that came out from his agent about how Ozil was feeling scapegoated, which came out on February the 15th, I think, and he's made two substitute appearances since. That's it. You know, if it was happening at another club, you'd be really suspicious, wouldn't you? If it was happening with another player, if a manager, you know, was happening, this kind of ongoing angst was being made public, you'd think, well, look, there's something definitely suspicious, something fishy going on, and I think there may well be with Mesut Ozil. I don't quite know what it is, but, you know, we're long enough in the tooth not to take everything at face value, so...
Because, yeah, my question would be, what's going on with him that isn't going on with Alexis? Do you know what I mean? Like, I know they're different situations, but contractually they're in the same position, and Arsene still seems to be relying on Alexis. I guess maybe the fact that, Ozil maybe isn't an automatic pick right now in terms of the tactical shape of the team, and, you know, maybe he's not too happy about that. I mean, it's complete guesswork at this stage, but... I would expect him to play for Germany in the international break, and I don't necessarily expect him to play for Arsenal against Manchester City when we come back.
I mean, it's kind of mad, isn't it? The way that situation from a few months ago when he was scoring goals and playing really well and viewed as a hugely important player, not just for this season, but for the future of the football club, things have turned around so dramatically that there are people now who are saying, I don't care if Mesut Ozil goes or stays. And when he's left out of a team or out of a squad to go and face West Brom, nobody's really that bothered. People weren't that bothered. I think it's, you know, it's really a shame what's happened. I don't know, like you, I don't know the nuts and bolts of it or what's caused this schism, if there is one. But, you know, it really is a shame because he's a fantastic player. And a guy who, in the right setup, would be absolutely outstanding. But
has been at times.
For us. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, let's not forget what he contributed last season, you know, smashing assists records and all sorts of things. And I think in the first half of the season, I always think of that goal against Ludogorets. So, you know, at that moment in time, Ozil was absolutely the top of his game. And we were talking about how he developed a goal-scoring edge, you know, he was instrumental in defeating Chelsea. It's all just fallen away for him, and you know, the kind of rhetoric around those contracts, I mentioned it briefly in the first half, but, you know, we'll deal with it hopefully before Christmas, we'll deal with it in January, and now it's just silence from all parties, and that feels very, very ominous indeed. I mean, in my head, I'm resigned to them both going. What about you?
Yeah, I would be surprised.
I mean, the one thing I think that could keep them
is a new manager.
The one thing I think could get is a new manager. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it would be more of a surprise to me if they stayed. And then how the fuck do you rebuild? How do you rebuild your team after losing two players like that? The reputational damage on its own. Do you attract players of that caliber to come to a club when they're looking at it going, look, Arsenal looks fucking chaotic enough as it is at the moment. The fans are going crazy because the manager has signed a new two-year deal. Do I want to go and play in that atmosphere? And do I want to go and play for a club that can't keep players like Ozil and Sanchez rather than adding to them? They just do the same thing. I mean, there's no excuses this time. No financial excuses when we lost players like Fabregas and Van Persie. There was a financial element, but there was also a sporting competitive element to it as well, which was tied to that financial element, not being able to invest as much in the team as we would have liked. But now that's not there. That is not there. We spent big money. No. We spent fucking £90 million. I know United spent that on one player, but everybody views that as vaguely ridiculous. But we spent £90 million on, you know, Mustafi, Xhaka, and Lucas Perez. And somebody else.
That's big money.
Yeah, it is big money. It's a big investment in a squad that has gone backwards.
It's, yeah, and if they do go, it's because they don't believe in the project, basically.
Yeah.
And that's a very damning thing indeed.
Yeah.
I think they will both go. I think if it was announced now that there was going to be a managerial change, then maybe they'd stick around to see, you know, if it was someone they had a relationship with or what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah, if Yogi Love's coming in, maybe Mesut Ozil goes, oh, okay, you know. But I think as things stand, I don't think they're into it. And I think they know they could go somewhere else and be immediately more competitive. Right. This question is from Claire Adams at Claire's Mick on Twitter. This is a tough one for you, okay? But simple question. She says it's a simple question. She's lying.
Right.
What positives are there for Arsene staying for two more years? Let's look on the bright side.
What positives are there? Or what positives could there be?
Yeah, I guess what could there be? What positives could we derive? If Arsene Wenger is going to sign a new deal, if it's signed and it's done, and they're just waiting for the awkward moment to tell us, is there any good in that?
The only thing that I could see as being a positive is if that two-year period were used to properly transition the club to a more modern setup, to a time when the manager or the head coach, whoever he is, does not have all the power that Arsene Wenger has, whereby we have a sporting director, where we have a new academy manager, where we have a director of football or a transfer fixer, where we have an upgraded coaching staff, where we have an upgraded scouting network, that if those things are put in place over the course of the 2 years of Arsene Wenger's contract, then I think that could be a long-term positive for the club. Now,
go on.
I don't believe that any of that will happen.
So, okay.
Unless someone like Robert Pires is appointed sporting director. Now, he doesn't have huge experience as a football administrator. And could he work and learn from Arsene Wenger and in 2 years' time be absolutely top, you know, shipshape to do that job with a new manager where he would have a measure of control and authority? That's the, you know, but Robert Pires isn't going to come in and be sporting director and start signing players over Arsene Wenger's head, for example. That's not going to happen. Whoever they appoint as sporting director will have no control or authority over the manager. So the only way that appointment can be made is somebody who's happy to maybe learn the job during those 2 years, and then when the time comes, yeah, they can step up and take a bit more control. But I don't see, Wenger doesn't change his coaching staff. Very rarely does he change the coaching staff,
The problem with appointing someone like a Pires or even anyone really while Arsene Wenger is still there is that if the idea is to bring in someone who can challenge the manager and put some exert some pressure on him and, you know, kind of wrestle with him for authority, like Arsene Wenger, it'll be like Gazidis, you know, he'll be on the interviewing panel. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It won't be a functional relationship. And I guess the question becomes, yes, we have to do a lot of work on the kind of infrastructure of the club. We need to make several appointments. The question is it easier to do that with Arsene Wenger there or with a new man there? Mm. And I think that, you know, there's an argument, okay, it's easier with Arsene Wenger, we can kind of make a smoother transition. But I actually think because of the nature of the man, it's actually probably quite difficult to put those people around him. He's resisted it for 20 years. People become more intransigent as they get older. It'd be quite a change if he suddenly was like, okay, I flip my managerial philosophy. I'm happy these other cooks to come in and meddle with my broth.
Excuse me, Mr. Leopard, would you please change your spots?
Exactly. It seems improbable. And I do think while it would make it very difficult for a new manager to come into a club with that much change happening that quickly, I still think that's going to be more expedient than expecting Arsene Wenger to evolve.
Mm.
I mean, because all the things that people are scared of about changing the manager, I kind of think we're already living through them. You know, like, it's like when people say, oh, well, we can't make an announcement saying he's going because the players, their concentration might go. And I'm like, well, did you see the West Brom game?
Yeah.
Their concentration's gone. Trust me, that can't get worse. And then people go, well, if we bring in someone new, you know, we could be, you know, it could be kind of like the David Moyes era, you know? And I'm like, well, I mean, it's not quite as bad as that, but this isn't like going from title winners. You know, there is quite a strong chance it could get better. Whereas United were champions, you know, when Ferguson went.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, we're sixth now. I mean, you know, I think David Moyes was seventh when he got sacked. I know the league's not finished, judge me in May and all that, but I just think that, and in some ways I think that could be a good thing because it's like we are experiencing some of the pain of transition with Arsene Wenger still at the helm. It's terrible for Arsene Wenger, and it's terrible for those who love him because we wanted him to go out on this massive high, but we are kind of halfway through that process.
Yeah.
With him still there. Like, I think we might be nearer the bottom of the curve than we think.
Yeah.
I
think that's a good point. Yeah,
I just haven't. I mean, I haven't really answered the question about what's positive about him staying, because to be honest, I mean, I've got more questions. Shall I do more questions? Because I think it's related.
Yeah, go on.
Is that all right? I know it's not strictly my turn, but you know, I'm messing with it.
Hey, it all goes out the window today.
Yeah, it all goes out the window. But where have I put it? That is the question. Yes, Jordan Parkin on Facebook says if Arsene Wenger does decide to extend his contract, do you expect the protest to continue for 2 years or will people try and get behind him? I can't see anything but a toxic atmosphere involving Wenger from now on. I mean, if this news does come to pass, do you think people will rally and say, well, look, that's the decision of the board, we can't get behind it? Or do you think it's no?
Okay. I don't think they will. I don't think they will. I mean, I'm not of the opinion either that a new manager will suddenly heal all the divisions that exist within the fan base. I think it'll certainly quiet things down and it would be like turning over a fresh page. You know, I get that, but I still think that the minute a new manager has a difficult period, there'll be a lot of, meh, told you. You know, there'll be a lot of that going on as well. But will the protests stop? No, I don't think so. And it is. It's incredibly... It's growing increasingly toxic. I mean, here's a question from James McTaggart at Jimmy the Hat 814, who wants to know, if Wenger is set to stay, what would he have to do in the transfer window to win the fans back? I mean, think about that. Just, I looked at that question and my mind went, like, fuck.
Well, the first thing that came to my mind is keep Alexis and Erzurum.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure he can do that.
Yeah.
Especially if he finishes sixth or fifth. You know, I think it's going to be nigh impossible. So, it's such a huge uphill battle. Given, you know, kind of the doubts that already exist about him and that he might lose his two best players. I mean, if it's in Wenger's thoughts that he could stay on and turn it around, I mean, he must also see the risk that it gets even worse.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, like, the protest... We haven't talked about the planes and, you know, Sir Chip's paying from Hong Kong for his planes.
Well, look, you know, I don't know that that's... I mean, it sounds so fucking ludicrous and surreal, you know, that it could be true. I don't know that that's a fact. That was... I think I saw this on Twitter the other morning. Tim Payton from the AST... mentioned the Hong Kong thing and then mentioned the name of a company which is run by the brother of Sir Chips, and Sir Chips' son, I think, works there as well. And that was, you know, maybe putting two and two together and getting four, but it could also have been, you know, two and two together and getting, you know, five or 12. You know, there's a lot of people in Hong Kong.
Sure, a lot of Arsenal fans as well.
A lot of Arsenal fans. And look, you know, it does make some bizarre sense, but you know, I don't want to entertain conspiracy theories like that. And I also think that watching the game on Saturday, it was like first plane goes over, you go, for fuck's sake, like, you know, it's just fucking nuts. And then another plane, I was expecting a third one. If another plane had gone, or fucking Phileas Fogg in a hot air balloon was hanging out, throwing out flyers about Wenger in or Wenger out or two more, you just wouldn't have fucking batted an eyelid, would you? That's what the fucking... No. That's what this... It's crazy that this is what things have come to. That people think spending money on fucking planes to fly above a football ground in the middle of a match is a good idea. Arsenal are driving people fucking mad. They're driving them insane.
I mean, we're literally having a conversation about if the chairman's family chartered a plane to fly over the ground to you know, state a coded message of support for the manager. I mean, I don't know what's going on, but
what the fuck is happening?
The question anymore. It's just mental now.
Yeah,
it's absolutely mental.
And I'm
at the sort of... I'm at my wit's end, really. Mm. I'm at my wit's end. I don't really know what to make of it anymore.
All right, here's a question from... A couple of questions here on players, actually. Chris Loco, at Chris Loco _, says, so many things I love about Hector, but speed aside, is it possible he's actually just a shit defender? And Martin Fisher, who's at Marty_Fish, wants to know, is Mustafi Arsene Wenger's worst ever signing, considering timing, price tag, etc.?
Well, I mean, on Bellerin, Tokyo Gooner on Twitter said, hello, what is the best way to get Bellerin to change his hairstyle? There's like a kind of reverse Samson thing going on.
Yeah.
The longer his hair gets, the worse he seems to play. He has actually been quite a lot worse since he came back from his injury, I would say.
I have a theory.
Go on.
I don't think he's fit. I don't think he's fully fit in any way. I think he's still got a problem with his ankle. That's my feeling. It makes sense.
Because there are no other right backs.
Right. What was the thing? Throw this out there, completely random. What was the first thing you noticed about Hector Bellerin when he broke into the team? What's the most obvious thing about him?
Quick.
Yes. Now, what is the most obvious thing about Hector Bellerin at this moment in time?
Hair.
Hair, okay. But also, he's being outpaced by players who have no business outpacing him. Think about the Hector Bellerin that chased back from the halfway line and made an incredible tackle to prevent a goal. Like, fucking Billy Whiz he was. Mm. Absolutely amazing pace. And now you look at him and he looks like he's running through treacle. So what's happened? Have his muscles just fucking atrophied? No. Is it likely that he's playing with an injury that's preventing him reaching his potential? Yes. That's what I think about Hector. Anyway.
I think that's very plausible. Or he really wants Arsene Wenger out. It's one of those two things, isn't it? As for Mustafi, funnily enough, I watched Valencia yesterday and I noticed that they replaced Mustafi with Eliakim Mangala. There's some sort of poetry about that, I guess, because he was another £35 million signing for the Premier League who didn't quite look up to scratch. I think that I'm loath to come down completely harshly on Mustafi because I saw signs in the early part of the season that he could develop into a top defender. But when you look at the size of the fee, you know, for Arsene Wenger, a manager who loves extracting value for players, it's difficult to argue that he's been value for money. Certainly, that's fair to say.
Yeah, look, my feeling on it is that I think his impact at the start of the season was slightly overblown, in the sense that people were saying, well, he hasn't lost a game and Arsenal's defence is a lot better than it was because we've got Mustafi. And I'm not sure that was true. I think defensively we still had issues. And what's maybe different now is certainly he's not playing as well as he was, but those defensive issues are being punished more regularly than they were in the first part of the season. I'm also loath to really come down hard on individuals, especially players who are maybe in the first season with the club, like Granit Xhaka, like Mustafi, who have come in and they're part of a team that is dysfunctional. I think it's a bit difficult to start pointing fingers at individuals, at all the individuals anyway, when I think there's a bigger problem with the team's collective efforts. You know, I look at somebody like Victor Moses at Chelsea, who was a guy who was, where did he go? He went to West Ham on loan. He was from Palace. He came from Wigan, didn't he?
Yeah, they signed him from Wigan. He'd been back on loan at Palace. He'd basically been a bit of a Premier League journeyman. Loan spells at Liverpool, Stoke and West Ham.
Yeah, so there you go. Not a player that many people would have considered useful, I guess, for a team that was going to try and win the title. And you look at what's happened to him under Antonio Conte at Chelsea and the collective difference he's made. You know, players look good in good teams and players can look bad in bad teams or teams that are struggling. And I think as a team, we're struggling and also individuals are struggling as well. And that's why I think there's also a good case to be made for a new manager in the sense that, you know, people think that, you know, new manager, get in 8-10 new players. It's not going to happen. It's going to be more or less the same squad for a new manager. But you might get more out of these players with more organization, with more defensive awareness, with more training ground drills, how to defend, how to move the ball from midfield to attack, how to penetrate in the final third. If it looks like you've got players, you know, just if a message from the manager or the coach is getting through to the players, I think you get more from the players. So that's my feeling on that guy.
Yeah, I mean, on the subject of Mustafi, this is kind of a related question, I guess. Mark Caney said, is it time to bring the club captain back into the side? Wenger has previously always trusted him. The centre-back pairing currently looks weak and it might give us a bit of leadership back on the field.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. You know, there's another question here. Richard Layton, who's at the Arsenal game, afterwards Arsene Wenger said, we're in a unique bad moment, I think he said, because of the amount of games that we've lost. And Richard asks, Arsene Wenger said it's a unique situation he's not had before, so will he do something unique to change things? And you're looking at the team now and you're thinking, well, you've got to do something. You've got to do something more than just pick the same guys and giving them the chance to go out and make amends for the poor performance. You have to at this point. So, yeah, I don't know how much he can do, really, but I don't see why not. Why not bring Mertesacker back into the side for a little bit? Let Mustafi sit out a few games. I don't see any...
I mean, the tricky thing about Mertesacker is I'm not even sure... Obviously, he's been training for a few months now, but I was convinced he would play in the cup game at home to Lincoln. I thought that was a great opportunity for him to come back in, but in the end, Mustafi played. I'm not even sure he's been involved with the under-23s, really.
No.
To Saka. Like, you know, Danny Welbeck was given a lot of game time to get up to speed. It almost feels as if a decision's been taken on Mertesacker that, look, we'll just get you through the rest of the season, and then, you know, you'll have your pre-season and start next season proper. I mean, he was on the bench at the weekend, but so was Gabriel, and you almost suspect that if Mesut Ozil had travelled, maybe Mertesacker wouldn't have done. So,
yeah.
I actually would love a fit Mertesacker to come back into the side. I think that would be really helpful, but I just don't feel that he can possibly be up to speed with so little game time under his belt.
Yeah, that's a fair point as well, but I think we're approaching a desperate times, desperate measures kind of situation, aren't we? I mean, what sort of a team is he going to be able to pick for the Manchester City game? Obviously, we're hoping players go away on international duty and aren't injured and come back fit and healthy, but, you know, he doesn't have a huge amount to work with over the next couple of weeks. So maybe he might be inclined to use a couple of players who've been around on the training ground for that period of time. But even against West Brom, you know, starting Danny Welbeck up front, when's the last time he did that? Still didn't work.
Yeah, that was a curious one. I mean, when I saw the front three, I thought it would be Alexis through the middle, actually, and Welbeck out on the left. And I probably would have preferred that just because I think Alexis gives you so much variety in that central position. But, yeah, look, I mean, I'd love to see him try something radically different tactically, you know, a back three or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But I guess an international break is kind of a nightmare time to try and implement that because you sometimes don't even get the players back until a day or two before the game.
Mm. All right, have you got one more? Or?
I probably do. Let me have a look. I probably do, but I don't know if I want to do it. You know, it's sort of like they're all... what about this? Diehard ONVHS, who's at DieselFW on Twitter, says, how about we all boycott the men's team for a bit and give our time, money and support to the women's team? There was some good Arsenal news this weekend.
Yeah, blimey, what a win.
Did you see that scoreline?
I saw the scoreline. Tell the people.
Well, the Arsenal ladies team defeated their Tottenham counterparts by 10-0.
Get in there.
Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, double figures. That's, you know, imagine when they got to 9, then the fans must have been baying for a 10th. 10 is like, 10 is huge. 10 is extraordinary. I mean, 10-0.
10-0. You know, if Tottenham finish above us this season for the first time in many years, we just reply 10-0. Our ladies beat your ladies 10-0. Nothing else matters.
Yeah.
That's it.
10-0. I mean, you know, obviously the men's team are going to finish above us in the league this year, and that's awful. But 10-0 to the women's team.
Do you think there's any chance that Spurs can still Spurs it? Or are we just not in a position to take advantage of their inevitable Spursing?
They look less like Spurs than they ever have. That's what worries me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I feel like over the past decade, both clubs have kind of had a capacity to kind of implode a bit. You know, we would be right near the top and then we would get a bit Spursy, but then we would rally and finish fourth. And that they would be about fourth and then get about all Spursy and finish about sixth. And the problem is that now those positions are reversed. And I mean, look, we'd have a game at White Hart Lane, which means it's a chance to reduce the deficit significantly. But I have no confidence in our capacity to go there and get a result.
Mm. I don't want to think about that.
It's really shit, that one, because I feel like... I mean, we haven't really talked about the whole top four thing, but, you know, we're not in it right now. And when I look at some of the teams ahead of us, they just seem so much more built to grind out results. You know, I think of Manchester United and Spurs and Chelsea, those are all teams that I just think, they've got a habit of getting the job done this season.
Yeah, I mean, look, you kind of always had faith in Arsenal to be able to have that late season rally, you know, to dig in and to, like, you think back to that time when, God, we lost at White Hart Lane, didn't we? And Vermaelen was terrible at centre half, and I think that's when he started Mertesacker and Koscielny.
In Munich, it was, yeah.
Yeah, and we
dropped Szczesny as well.
Yeah, exactly. No, we dropped, was it Szczesny or Fabianski?
Oh, he dropped someone. He dropped a keeper. Yeah,
I think it could have been Szczesny actually, but Fabianski came in and then got injured, so Szczesny came back in. But what happened was we started grinding out results. I think a couple of 1-0s and 1-2-1s and stuff like that. I can remember a lot of games being quite unpleasant to sit through.
I remember a game at QPR where we were, like, you know, so defensive, just sat back, you know, and like. was literally eight men behind the ball most of the time.
Yeah, I remember quite a few of those, and I think that was the season as well. Was that not the season where we ended the season at West Brom when Arsene Wenger and Pat Rice were, you know, clinging onto each other, or Arsene Wenger was clinging to Pat Rice, you know, just the sheer terror of that. But, you know, you sort of had this faith in the team to be able to do something in the final stages of the season, and we did it more than once, and they would dig in and they get a run of good results. But it's very hard to look at this team and think that they're capable of doing it, and you look at the fixtures, and the fixtures are quite scary, actually. They really are. When you look at what we've got between now and the end of the season, Manchester City at home, we've got West Ham at home, Palace, Borough, we've got Tottenham away, we've got Manchester United at home, we've got Stoke away, and we've got Everton away. No, Everton at home on the final day of the season. So, you know, there's a game that could be hugely important as well. So, I don't know. It feels like it would be a huge achievement now, doesn't it, to finish in the top four?
Yeah, it would be massive, and it would require several teams to kind of Spurs it up, really. A couple of teams, at least, you know. I for some reason, Liverpool don't worry me too much. I feel like we could finish above them, but we're now in a position where we're chasing Mourinho, and that's never really gone well for us in the past.
Blech.
Yeah.
All right. A couple of quick ones just before we finish. Jane Cavendish says, I'll still go to the Arsenal every week, but any recommendation for a new sport to follow for a couple of years? In brackets, not golf. And Steve Moore 4116 wants to know, can you recommend any other good hobbies to take up of a weekend?
I mean, honestly, you could just punch yourself in the face repeatedly. I think that would maybe be more fun. Hobbies. I don't know. I think I'm going to have to get one. It's a worry, isn't it? I mean, drinking seems to have gone quite well for you this weekend.
Yeah. It hasn't changed the reality of anything, but...
Sure.
Yeah.
Passes the time.
I don't know. What could you do that would be less infuriating than football? Pretty much anything, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I think you could just sort of go, you know, approach a wasp's nest naked. I mean, anything... would be better.
Yeah, stick your cock in a wasp's nest.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we'll keep watching it, but I mean, it's a fascinating soap opera, at least, I guess.
It is that. And for another sport to follow, given that we're heading towards the summer, if people haven't seen it, I'm sure many people will, all my Irish listeners will know this one, but the game of hurling is a very exciting and mental sport. It's basically a ball being smashed around an enormous pitch at high speed by guys with big sticks, and they fucking lash each other out of it as well. Lots of scoring. Like, you're going to see lots of scoring. No, like, 1-0s or anything like that. Hello. Ooh,
my doorbell.
Your doorbell.
I better go and answer it.
You better.
Do you want to explain hurling while I do?
I think I just did.
Okay, well, sorry, one sec.
No, you go ahead then. You're back.
Sorry about that. That's very insistent.
Yeah.
They were ringing a lot.
They were. Anyway, it gave us a chance to use that fun interval music that people enjoy.
Yeah.
So that would be my recommendation for somebody looking for a sport, hurling. I don't know where you're going to get it on the TV. Oh, you do. I think Sky Sports have some of the rights to hurling. So that could be something to keep your mind off things for the next couple of years.
Well, there you go. Bit of hurling, yeah. Why not? Let's give it a go. I mean,
give it a hurl.
I can't even speak anymore because of Arsenal.
Yeah.
That's awful, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Ah, dear.
Oh well. Okay. Well, look. I think probably we should stop talking now because I don't know what else we can say.
It's been enough, hasn't it? An hour and a half. I think we've been chatting for.
Yeah.
Long enough. Anyway.
Yeah. Good value for money. This podcast today. Not going to make anyone feel any better or anything, but You know, it is what it is. And look, you know,
there might be some therapeutic benefit.
Yeah. A problem shared is a problem halved and all that. I'm not sure that applies in this case to football. We've been sharing our problems for a long time and I don't feel any better.
No, what we need is, you know, a director of football and head of the academy so that the coaching staff can all share their problems. That would be a better structure.
Exactly.
Rather than Arsene Wenger carrying them all on his own.
Right. Well, look, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as ever, for listening. If you've stuck with us all the way through this one, a big podcasting thumbs up to you. Manly hugs.
You're gluttons
all
for punishment as well.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all gluttons for punishment.
Indeed. All right. Well, look, we'll be back next week in the middle of an interlull to talk about whatever the hell is going on there. Probably Arsene Wenger's new 7-year contract. But we'll do that. I don't know what we're going to do this weekend, if we're going to have a podcast this Friday, because I don't know if we can talk about this or if I can talk about this again. Maybe some exciting things will happen between now and, maybe we can go and stick our Mickeys in a wasp's nest and report back to a podcast on that.
And it's live.
Screams ahoy. All right. Thanks, folks. Catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.